I feel that I'm not his. And I want to feel that I am his. Yeah. And I feel that I've done everything within my power. I've done everything outwardly, inwardly. I've given up everything I'm capable of.
Don't say anything out that service. You have been doing it for past 20 years. Don't try to just say the thing out and within 10 minutes finish off your 20 years of longing for him. Don't do that. Baba told us. He stopped somebody who was trying to narrate to him what has happened for so many years I'm with you. So Baba rushes to him and puts his arm on his face. Says, don't try to waste all these years within 10 minutes like that by narrating to me these things. Said, yes, but you have to hear the other side of the story, brother. You haven't heard the second side of it. Only one story he heard. Steve, come to my rescue. Where is Steve?
Yeah, I'm
here.
About the slave. And now, don't look at the clock. Let the clock stop, you see. But give the full description of the story of what happened to the slave who loved him and wanted to be with him and have something of him, that he was so deprived of his physical presence, so deprived of anything worth having and nothing. Who was that? Please, don't make him feel comfortable, but just tell the story. then the arrow that has pierced through his heart, it will be pulled out, you see.
Well, this is a story about a slave who, I should say, had many arrows through his heart.
Listen, John, listen.
I was checking to see if it was...
And, first of all, he was born a slave.
Born
a slave.
Born a slave, yeah.
So his life from the beginning was wretched.
Yeah.
And as he grew up, instead of just being resigned, this is my lot, although he had no education... And he had trouble articulating, you know, complicated ideas, but the thought within him was, this isn't fair. What have I done to deserve this? That it's not as if I was captured in battle or something that had some honor to it. By an accident of birth, I'm a slave. And he couldn't accept that. It just seemed so unfair to him. And because of that, his whole relationship with his master was one of secret rebellion. If he ever spoke out openly, killed on the spot. And he knew that. All slaves knew that. So what he would do is, in little ways, he would do anything he could to thwart his master.
To
the master
thwart,
upset, foil. If the master said, take this flock of sheep, herd of sheep to pasture. And if there's any choice, he would pick the most miserable pasture. So he followed the master's orders, but in such a way that the work was not done. His master, as it turns out, was a trader. This was in Arabia. He lived in Arabia. And so there wasn't much farming or grazing, but mostly trade. And if a camel strap got broken, the master, say, would fix it. So he fixed it. But in such a way that with luck, in 3 or 4 days in the middle of the desert, it would break. And maybe everything would fall down and be ruined. That was his life. And the master appreciated that to the extent that he would beat him and whip him and try and knock some sense into him. And that only made him feel all the more, this is no life. This is not fair. And so I could go on at length, but that's his life.
The master understood what he was doing?
He could suspect. This is not the way to, you know, it's like, how many times have I told you do this first and not that? And you didn't have that experience with servants here.
Yeah.
So, one day, and he would try to avoid the master if he could. All slaves, best way to be happy is have the master there at a distance. But one day he happened to go by where the master was, and the master with the men friend in the evening were talking politics and news, and he hears the name Muhammad. And as soon as he hears the name, he gets like a deep inner shock. And he has this strong sense that this is the key to everything. But it's really frustrating because he has no idea what it means. It's like a secret code that he's been waiting to hear. He now has the message, but he has no idea what he's supposed to do. All he knows is that now, somehow, his life is linked with Muhammad. That's his destiny. But who's Muhammad? He has no idea. All he heard was the name. And he asked other slaves, have you heard anyone named Muhammad? Nobody had heard anything. So now he just has this burning desire to find out, who is Muhammad? What does it mean to me? How is it supposed to figure in my life? But he knows with certainty that this is his life now. So he starts finding excuses to go near the master, to overhear something. And the days pass, the weeks, the months, and he starts to hear little tidbits. And he learns that Muhammad was a trader. Well, not himself, but he handled the caravans for a wealthy widow. He hears that Muhammad marries the widow. Muhammad is considered to be the most truthful and trustworthy person. Little bits he picks up. And he starts to imagine, what does he look like? What does his voice sound like? Is he tall? How old is he? Because that's all he can do is think about Muhammad. And he gets little information about Muhammad, but just bits and scraps. But all of his time now spent trying to create a picture of Muhammad in his mind's eye. And of course, the main question, he still doesn't know. What does it mean to me? How is this going to help me? And time passes. And he starts to hear a little more of Muhammad. He hears that Muhammad now is preaching something in Mecca, something called Islam. He has no idea what it means, but he hears that in Islam, all are brothers. And as soon as he hears that within him, he thinks, yes, yes, this is the way it should be. This is something. This is what I've been waiting for. Then one day he hears that Muhammad's been driven out of Mecca. He's been stoned. And his response is, what? He has no followers? If I had been there, I know how to throw stones. I would have stood up for him. What is this, that nobody would stand up for him? And he has that feeling. And so he just keeps hearing more about Muhammad, getting more and more drawn to him, although basically he knows very little. And he finally hears that Muhammad has gone to Medina. But in Medina he's been accepted. And what is he doing now? Now he's almost like the Sultan of Medina because he's the lawgiver. And what kind of laws does he give? He gives laws about how people should be protected. You cannot divorce someone now on a whim. Now there's a law. You cannot have infinite number of wives. Even in warfare now, there are rules and regulations. And all these rules and regulations make him think, yes, yes, this is the way it should be. And he just starts thinking, oh, if only I were in Medina. If only I could be with Muhammad. And his work suffers. His work was never satisfactory. And now it becomes wretched, because he gets lost in thoughts of Muhammad. And one time, because he's thinking, Muhammad has come, and his thought is to bring justice and righteousness into the world. Because everything he hears makes him think that. All the rules and regulations that he hears nothing about the religious side, but he hears about the rules and regulations. And he thinks, yes, this is the way it should be. This is what I've been thinking all my life. And he even hears one day that one of Muhammad's close followers is Bilal, who was a slave. And again, perfect sense to him. Why shouldn't a slave be his companion? It never occurred to him that a slave could be, because that's not a slave's lot. But as soon as he hears, he thinks, of course, why didn't I think of that? This is the way it's going to be. So, just to give you an idea of the way his work has changed, one day the master tells him to get some water from the well. So he's drawing up the water, and he empties it out. And as he does, his thought comes to him, this is the water of righteousness. This is what Muhammad has come to irrigate the land with. And he gets so absorbed in the thought, he brings bucket after bucket and just keeps pouring the water of righteousness. And hours later, the master says, what's going on? He goes out to sea, and it's like a swamp now. Man's lost all awareness of what he's doing. He's just emptying bucket after bucket. And he doesn't beat him, because it's so clear that now this is something different. This is not passive aggression or whatever you want to call it. This man has now become feeble-minded. He's lost his wits. He tells him one time, he now is thinking, what job can this man do that he won't mess up? So one time, they have date trees. They have palm trees in Arabia. So he sends them with a machete to slash the tree, because you collect the sap, the like toddy. You collect the juice and you make a nice drink out of it. You ferment it, nice alcohol. So he gives him the sword, says, go do that, slash that tree, collect it. So he goes to feel the sword, whether it's sharp enough. And it's a fairly sharp sword, but he thinks instantly, this is like Muhammad's sword, the sword of righteousness. Because he heard now that there had been battles, that Muhammad was standing up for himself. So he wasn't just allowing himself to be driven out, but had defeated Mecca's armies in battles. So he's thinking, a warrior. And again, this really makes him feel like Muhammad is the one. And he feels, I wonder if Muhammad's sword of righteousness, how sharp that must be. And the story is just thinking about Muhammad slicing through all his enemies, all the injustice, all the unfairness in life. His image is Muhammad has come. He sees him on a war horse, just slashing through all the injustice in the world. And he just gets lost in the thought. He's just standing there lost. And hours later, again, the master comes, and he hasn't even made a single slash in the tree. So the master says, this guy is hopeless. Nothing to do. So he gives him no work to do, because he can't do any work. So the day comes, he thinks, I have a job for him. Although he said mostly he trades, but there's one small strip that he would farm. Now, he wants this man to plow, because the bullets, they know how to plow. You just walk. All this man has to do is stand on the plow. He goes, that's perfect. He can stand on the plow to give it enough weight to dig in. And he doesn't have to do anything. So he tells him to do this. And the slave goes, and he's standing on the plow. And suddenly the thought comes to him. Why am I doing this? Why am I obeying the master? I don't belong to him. I belong to Muhammad. And the thought had never occurred to him before. And as soon as it comes, it's like a revelation. I am Muhammad's. I don't belong here. And he just steps off the plow and starts walking to Medina. Without a moment, he just starts going. And the days pass. And we now shift to Medina. And Muhammad is sitting with some of his close ones and some that are not so close. They've already had the morning call to prayer. And they're just sitting there talking about this and that. And they look up and they're astonished because this man comes staggering into their midst. And his eyes are like slits. They're so puffed up. And he's completely white, where the salt, his perspiration is evaporating. He's just covered with salt. And they can see that he's been through some incredible ordeal, that he's been in the desert, it looks like, for days. And he comes straight to Muhammad. He says, I'm here. And he falls on Muhammad's feet. And they're astonished. Who is this man? What is he doing? And they're even more astonished because they see Muhammad looks at him and his eyes fill with tears. And they've never seen that in Muhammad. And Muhammad lets him be there for a minute and pats him. Get up, what are you doing? And makes him sit next to him. And Muhammad says, you're here, we can see that. But who are you? And he gives his name. Muhammad says, but where are you from? I can see you're not from Medina. And he names the town that he came from, where his master lived. And it's quite a distance away. So when Muhammad hears that, he says to one of the Mongoli, go see that his camel is provided for. And the man says, I have no camel. Well, horse, whatever it is, go see, take care of it. He says, no, I came on foot. You came on foot? Well, then what caravan did you come with? And the Mongoli start guessing, this trader, no, but he wasn't due back for a while. No, but remember the clan had a wedding party near that person's house, and he must have... And they're trying to figure out, how did he get here? He said, no, I didn't come with any caravan. I came alone. And I said, then you have large family? You have relations that put you up along the way? He says, no, I have no one but you. You're the only one I have in the world. And then Muhammad laughs, says, you must have looked like a donkey laden with so many provisions to come all that way across the desert. And he says, no, I had no provisions. I just came. How long did it take you? He said, I don't know. One moment I was plowing, and the next moment I was at your feet. That's all I know. So they're amazed at this. So Muhammad says, well, calls for some water. He washes his feet. And he calls for some ointment. He puts it on the man's face, the eyes and the lips that are so puffed up. He says, I have not fasted as long as you have, but I have also not eaten since the day before. Will you break your fast with me? Will you share my breakfast? And the slave says, of course. So he calls for some old dried dates and some bread. Now, as you know from some other stories, Muhammad liked green dates. But he figured this man's stomach won't be able to handle that. He's a slave. He's used to coarse fare. So he calls for just bread and dates so the man won't feel embarrassed. And he shares his breakfast with him.
And while the man's eating,
they start talking about different things. Let the attention go somewhere else. He suddenly turns to someone and talks. Then after a while, Muhammad turns back to him and says, well, we know you're here now. We know you've come, but why have you come? I've come to be yours. I am yours. I heard you call me and I have come. He said, but mine? Do you even know who I am? He said, yes, you're Muhammad. You are the instrument of God to bring righteousness into the world. Wow. That's something. Muhammad looks impressed with that. Looks at, you hear that? And so some of them laugh. And because there's that gesture, you know, that's, oh, listen to that praise. And it had two meanings. For those who are around, it was a joke. You know, Muhammad is being self-deprecating, a little humor. But to the monthly, it's like, you hear what he's saying? He's never seen me before, and he says this. What are you, wretches? What do you think? But the man, when Muhammad does that, he thinks, oh, Muhammad is rebuking me because I haven't spoken truly. And he feels that. As soon as Muhammad does that, he feels, it's true. Instrument? He's not an instrument. And he says, no, forgive me. You are God's angel come to bring his righteousness into the world. That's even better. Muhammad again does it. And then again feels the rebuke. And so he says, no, you are God himself come to establish his truth and justice in the world. And suddenly Muhammad looks very serious at this. And again, there's a double message. And the message for the Mandali is, you hear what he's saying? You still have doubts. You have been with me many years. You have doubts. This man is now speaking the truth. And he has never been with me. Look at his faith. Look at his love that gives him that vision. But to the ones that aren't so close, they get a different message. They see Muhammad's face get stern. And they realize, no. This is blasphemy. And they speak out. Because all these years, Muhammad, you've taught us there is no God but Allah. And you are only his prophet. What he says is blasphemy. This is what the Christians say about Jesus, which you told us is wrong. And so they get very upset. And with Muhammad, they can see they're right. Muhammad is looking stern and grave. At the same time, Muhammad reaches over and squeezes the man's leg, which makes him feel, yes, now you have said the right thing. Now you can be right. So Muhammad, to break the tension, says, look at what he looks like. Look at his experience in the desert. He does, you know, he's dazed from the sun. Let it go. Let him say whatever. He doesn't know. What would you say if you just come out of the desert after so many days? And so he kind of, you know, just makes the situation pass. So he said, so you've come to surrender to me, to be mine. Muhammad puts out his hand. I accept. I accept it. You are mine. Man is so happy. He says, but now that you are mine, what will you do? Anything you tell me to do. Anything I will do. So he says, but did you have family? He says, no, you're the only one I have in the world. He said, but you were farming. You said you were plowing. What about your animals who will take care of them? He says, but they weren't my animals. Well, then whose animals were they? He said, I used to work for somebody. I was a slave for someone. Oh, and your master gave you your freedom? He says, no, I heard you call. Someone said, okay, my first order, will you obey? He says, yes, anything you say. Go back and serve your master. He's stunned. He says, I haven't come for that. I'm not his slave. Someone said, no, you're not his slave. You're my slave. And I am telling you, you are not serving your master. Never think from now on that you are serving your master. You are serving me, because I am giving you the order. Does he ever beat you? So, well, he used to, but lately, for some reason, he hasn't been. Don't worry. He won't beat you again. But if he should, remember, I am the one beating you, and it's for your own good. Your master no longer exists. I am the only one, you said it yourself, I am the only one in the world, and it is true. I am the only one in the world for you. Go back. And then Muhammad turns to one of the Mandi and says, didn't we have a message that had to go, and he names a nearby town? Is the caravan ready that was taking it? Of course, this is spur of the moment. No such thing. And they said, oh yes, it's almost ready in 5 minutes. He said, good, turns back. You can help guide them. You know the way. They will go to this town, and the town is nearby. And you will go quickly that way. Go now. Go. And the man's gone. Not only does he have to go back, but so quickly. It's like he just came in Muhammad's presence, and Muhammad is sending him away. And Muhammad leans over and whispers up in his ear. And the man's astonished. He looks at Muhammad. And he just folds his hands, and he gets up to go. And he goes back. He leaves, and those who are watching this interplay are just, they're astonished by the whole scene. It was so poignant. The man's love was so palpable. His longing, his desire to serve. And Muhammad sends him away. So, what did you say to him? What did you say to let him go? You made him go. And Muhammad said, I just told him that my sword of righteousness is so sharp that unless you know how to handle it, you will cut yourself if you try. And when the slave had heard that, he thought two things. One, Muhammad knows. He knows what I've been thinking. He knows my desires. But he also thinks there's a rebuke there. I am being hurt. I'm being cut right now by being sent away for some fault of mine. I don't know how to handle the sword of righteousness. So he goes back. And now his life is different. Because now,
but all this was preface to the story that is to come now.
This is background.
Yeah, just to give you an idea of the whole picture. Now the story begins.
Because now begins his life of serving Muhammad, but by serving his master, his old masters, which is very, very difficult for him. Because it's easy. It's easier, he feels it would be easy, to die at Muhammad's feet. But to serve an ordinary human with ordinary human capabilities, he's not appreciative, he's a grouch, he loses his mood, to put up with that is very difficult. And he makes many mistakes. But he keeps thinking, no, it is not he, it is Muhammad I am serving. So he tries harder to serve. And that now becomes his life. His life becomes trying to please Muhammad by serving this man. So the man discovers that now when he tells the slave to do a job, he does it with such thoroughness that he himself would not do it that way. Whereas before he went out of his way to see if the work was not done, now he will do extra work that this master never ordered because he knows I have to do that to really accomplish the work. And if Muhammad asked me to do it, that's how I would do it. And that's now how he looks at everything. When he does work, is it good enough? He thinks, if Muhammad had asked me to do it, would I be satisfied now? And only when he feels like, yes, this would please Muhammad, only then will he say the work is done. And then time goes by, and he'll get the awareness, no, but you stinted. You really didn't give your all to that. The master was pleased, but you know in your heart you could have worked harder. You could have done more. So then he would say, okay, next time I will really please him. I won't hold myself back at all. And next time what happens? Holds back. Impossible. His whole life becomes trying to give that wholehearted service that will please Muhammad, which is almost impossible. And yet the master is amazed at the transformation. And he sees, he's just dumbfounded. This man has lost his wits, disappears for days, comes back and now is such a hard worker. He can't believe it. He doesn't know what's going on. And of course, you don't talk to a slave. You don't go, what's happening? You just don't do that. You give an order and the slave obeys. But he's amazed at the slave's obedience. And he starts to put him in charge of more things and more things. And he becomes almost a manager of the entire estate. Because he realizes after a while, I can trust this man. This man has no self-interest. And when the slave will make a suggestion sometimes, excuse me, but wouldn't the work be better this way? Slaves don't do that. But this man will do that. He will not talk back, but he will contradict an order and say, no, shouldn't it be this way? And the first time it happens, he gets furious. But after a while, the master realizes, why is he saying that? because he has my interest at heart. He's seeing that the work will be done better this way. So the relationship changes entirely to the point where sometimes the master will even tell the slave, ask him, what do you think? This is what I want to do. How do you think I should do it? And the slave will tell him. And in fact, one time the slave comes to him and says, I really feel you ought to increase the amount of food you're giving the slaves. What? What is this of yours? This is none of your business. He says, no, but think of the caravan that you sent last week. Before it went out, what did you do? He said, well, I fed the camels because I knew they were going to cross the desert. He said, yes. If you starved the camels, what would happen if you sent them out? They wouldn't be able to carry the load. If they survived at all, they could carry so little, you would make half as much money. It's the same with the slaves. Feed them for a few extra, little extra money in food, you'll get so much more money in work. Well, it makes sense. I mean, it's common sense. So he accepts it. So through the slave's service, the condition of all the slaves becomes better. And in fact, as the years go by, he would say, this is a model household, farm, business. This is the way a business should be run. There's now the master treats the slaves. Well, respect may be going too far for all the slaves. Respect for this slave, yes, but with justice. And one day the slave's thinking, if I looked at this, I would say this is justice. We get an honest, you know, we work hard, but we get fair conditions. There is justice here. There is some righteousness here. But he was miserable. He's thinking, why? Why is this? All my life I wanted some justice, some sense of fairness. Now the master treats me almost as an equal. And I'm unhappy. What is it I've missed? So he thinks back now about his time with Muhammad. How Muhammad treated him. And he remembers, as he thinks about it, Muhammad never mentioned justice, never talked about equality or righteousness, but he washed his feet. He shared his own breakfast with him. What was that? Wasn't that justice? And what comes to him suddenly, like a revelation again, it was justice, but it was more than that, it was love. He treated me as if he loved me. And the thought comes, that's what's been missing, the love. That love is the only scabbard that can hold the sword of righteousness. So now a second phase of his life, which is not just to serve, but to love. And to love as Muhammad loved him. And so now, just as all those years of trying to train himself to serve, now it's to love. And that becomes his life. Can I love? Can I have that love? Can I express that love? Can I serve with that selflessness of wanting to please others with no thought of my own? And this becomes his life. And the years go by. And he's getting older now. And this is his whole life. Can I love? And the more he does it, the more he feels, I don't love. I'm unworthy. I have no love at all.
He's loving the master? Is this what he said?
Everybody.
And the work.
Everybody. Other slaves, because Muhammad made no distinction. He could tell that. Now his life is one of trying to love, to express in his life the love he felt for Muhammad. But he can't do it. In the beginning, he has a little glimmer, oh, at times, a little bit I'm expressing love. But as years go on, he goes, I don't have love. I don't have any love. I'm completely unworthy. Which makes him try harder and harder. And one day, the master becomes so touched that he calls him in and says, how many years have you been with me now? And they calculate it. He doesn't know his birthday, but they figure out, you know, oh yes, you were born, and so and so happened. That was a big wedding, and they figure out the years. He says, the time has come for me to give you your freedom. And the slave just laughs. He says, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be disrespectful, but you can't give me my freedom. He says, what do you mean? You're my slave. He says, no, I'm not your slave. I am Muhammad's slave. And whatever you or the world does makes no difference to me. If you put me in chains, it won't affect me. If you say I'm free, it won't affect me. I am his. There's nothing you can do. And the master is just amazed. And so he hears about Muhammad, and he realizes that this is what it's been all about. So now he gets curious in Muhammad, and so he starts hearing news. Whenever he hears anything, he tells the slave, "Oh, did you hear what happened? Muhammad went back to Mecca. He's been accepted. This and that." The slave is so happy that people are beginning to accept Muhammad. Now years go by, and we shift to Mecca. And Muhammad now is old. And some of the close ones have that sense, his body is getting weak. How much longer can he last? So when they send word to their families, a few of them say, come now. Who knows if you'll get this opportunity again. Now is the time. Don't wait until whenever the regularly scheduled visit was going to come. And so some of the family members start to come. He says, what is this? What are you people telling, you know, your family? You think I'm going to die? No, it's just convenient. This was a good time to come visit. There's that interplay going on. So many people are starting to come now. I haven't called them. What's wrong with you folks? He said, no, that was good. They haven't seen you in so many months. I told them to come. Suddenly Muhammad gets the thought. Do you think that slave will come? He said, what slave? And he refreshes their memory. He refreshes the memory about the slave, and so many years ago he came, what's been going on. He said, why would he come? All these years he hasn't come, why would he come now? He said, no, but what if he comes? What if he comes? He said, but why would he come? And that goes on for a while. Why would he come? What if he comes? Then he said, but your family came. He said, yes, but we told our family to come. We're not sending out announcements to all of Arabia, come now. He said, no, but what if he comes? To such a point they've exasperated. And they say, well, what if he does come? So what? So what? Let him come. And I said, no. If he comes any time in the next 2 weeks, it's very important that he not come. They say, next 2 weeks? How's he going to come? Well, you told your family to come, isn't it? I said, yeah. I said, well, you know how family means women folk. What's going to happen? Word's going to spread. What if he hears that people are coming? He should come. He said, well, you know where he lives, because Mecca is south of Medina, and this man's house was even north of Medina. So it's an even longer trip now. It would take probably 2 weeks just for the word to reach him, and another 2 weeks for him to come. So even if we called him, he couldn't be here within a month. And he goes, oh, yeah, what you say makes sense. And he's happy. 5 minutes. What if he comes? So well, what if he comes? What do you want us to do? If he comes in the next 2 weeks, it's very important, don't let him see me. It's such a simple thing. He said, that's all? That's easily done. As soon as we see him, we'll hold him. He says, good. Don't let him see me. And so things pass. And Muhammad seems happy now. And the Mandali are happy because there's relief from that constant, what if he comes? What if he comes? And as it turns out, because the traitor is now interested in Muhammad, and because he's a traitor, he gets word. And he gets word that maybe some of the Mandali seem to feel Muhammad is poor health, that he's not doing well, and he tells the slave. And as soon as the slave hears it, he has to go. He has to go to Mecca. And the master says, yes, I understand. And he gives him his fastest horses to take, and gives him provisions. And the slave, of course, doesn't stop day or night, constantly going. As soon as one horse dies under him, he gets on another horse. And so, before the 2 weeks are up, the slave has arrived. The 14th day, and the slave is there. And he comes, and he sees hundreds of people there. Everywhere, the people, crowds, long lines of people. What is this? Don't you know? The prophet has died. He's just shocked. I came too late. He said, what are all these people doing here? They've come to pay their last respects. You mean his body is... He just died. His body is in his tent. We're coming to pay our respects. So he gets in line. The line moves slowly, 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 going to see the prophet, whom he knows. Not as the prophet, but as his own Muhammad. And he's getting closer. And one of the Mandali, he doesn't know the Mandali. In fact, years later, Someone asked him, how did you know to go to Muhammad when you first came? You'd never seen him. How did you know? I mean, had you heard some description and you recognized him? He said, it was easy. When I came, there was no one else there. There was only Muhammad sitting there. There was no one else. There was nothing about recognizing. One person there, Muhammad. So anyway, he's in line. And one of the Mandali said, he doesn't know the Mandali, but the Mandali comes up. And he seems to be saying something to everybody, asking them some question, and they say something, and they move on. So his turn comes, and he asks them the question, are you such and such a person who was a slave, and so on. He says, yes, I'm that one. He says, oh good, here, come with me. And he takes him out of the line, says, no, just stand here. So he stands. And time goes on, after a while, says, what is it? Why am I standing here? And they said, no, this is orders from Muhammad. He wants you just to be here. So happy. Muhammad gave orders about me. And so he's standing there. But the hours passed and people are filing in and he's standing there. So he says, what were the orders exactly? I mean, when do I get to pay my respects? And they said, no, Muhammad told us that you are not to see him. That we were to make you wait here. What? Muhammad said that about me? Yes. He was very specific. He told us that you would not have to see him under any circumstances. Can't believe it. He knew his whole life's experience was, I am not worthy of Muhammad. But to not be able to pay last respects to his body. And as he looks, I mean, little children are coming. Old warriors are coming with the old battle-scarred camels they're leading in. These were Muhammad's companions in warfare, and the camels are paying their last respects. He thinks animals are allowed to see him. And I am not. My love is so unworthy that out of all creation, I am not allowed to see Muhammad. It's just too much for him. But the mind comes to his rescue. And the mind says, but they must have made a mistake. This can't be true. Muhammad would never do that. So he's thinking, no, you're thinking of somebody else. Muhammad wouldn't say this. And they say, no, Muhammad gave us strict orders. You are that one. We know. You cannot come. So again, the mind says, well, for some reason, this man has lost his senses. He's got some grudge. Who knows? Muhammad did not say this. So he says, bring Ali. May I see Ali, please? Because Ali had the reputation of never telling a lie. And he knows, I will only believe this if Ali himself tells me Muhammad said this. So that's what he's clinging to. Why they would lie, how the mistake could happen, he can't figure out at all. But his only refuge is there's a mistake or a lie. He says, if Ali tells me, otherwise I will go and you won't be able to stop me. He says, okay, quick, wait here. Wait, promise you'll wait here, I'll get Ali. He says, I promise. So they go off. And Ali is seen to this and that, and they bring Ali. He says, Ali, you are Ali. Yes, tell me. There must be some mistake. What did Muhammad say? Is it true that I'm not allowed to see him? And Muhammad said, yes. And Ali said, yes. Muhammad gave orders if you came, we were not allowed to let you see him. He grabs his knife, the slave, and he's going to plunge it into his belly. Why live? If he's so wretched that his very existence gives Muhammad a pain, if his existence makes Muhammad so uncomfortable that animals are allowed to come before him, but he is not, there's no point in living at all. So he goes to kill himself. And in midair, Ali grabs his arm. And Ali, as you know, also has the reputation of one of the strongest men of the day, the champion of the cause. And he holds his arm. He says, don't do that. He says, why? There's nothing to live for because of what you told me. He says, no, but you haven't heard at all. There's more? I mean, what else? How could it be any worse? He says, but don't you want to know the reason Muhammad gave that order? And he has no interest in knowing the reason. But the mind is that little, mind always wants to survive. So that little spark of, why? Why did he? So he stops. This reason? Okay, tell me the reason. He might as well hear just how wretched, what specifically he had done to displease Muhammad. Who knows? If he knows what displeased Muhammad, maybe in some future life he won't make that mistake. So he asks, he says, why? Why did Muhammad give that order? And he said, you know, first Muhammad told us, he told all of us not to let you come, not to let you see. And then after a while, he sent everyone out of the tent, and only I was there. And he turned to me and he said, maybe you're wondering why I gave that order. Would you like to know the reason? So I said, whatever your wish. If you wish me to know, tell me. He said, his love for me is so great that if he were to come, even if I dropped my body, I would have to revive it to embrace him and to honor his love. And if I revive my body after dropping it, it will ruin the entire point of my incarnation. It will destroy everything I've worked for. Because his love is so great, I won't be able to restrain myself. And I will have to get up to embrace him and to honor his love. And that is why he gave the order.
So that's the other side.
Never heard that story.
Never heard it. But heard it from whom? From Steve. It was reserved specially for your question. If you feel so unworthy, it's all the better. Continue to feel that way. Okay. Why are you crying?
I might add, John, this is a story I heard many years ago from Paris.
To be truthful, I heard it from somebody else.
Somebody who was there.
Yeah, right. But the way he told me, some days ago, I don't know why he told me, tears trickled down my cheeks, because well, what I had told him was not that touching, the way that I told him. I just told him the gist and all that. But the way he made up the whole story, giving a vivid picture of the era at the time. Yeah. What happened? He told you in the dream, earlier, or he brought the vision before your eyes?
I guess it's boring cycling back and forth.
Yeah, so true. So that's how the other side is. So Johnny always he would say this to us, not to me, but I heard him say to the people around him. There were people who were so crazy that once they would come, they wouldn't want to leave him, physical presence. And Baba would say, why do you want to do that? Why are you crying? Why are you sad? My mansion is so vast, so very vast. Where will you be going? Nowhere. All that you will be doing is stepping from one room to another room and all. So, but that was no comfort to them also. Then he came with this little thing that, of course, as always I remember. He says, all that would keep you to me is not your physical body here, but your longing to be with me. So long for me, and that will always keep you present in my presence. So continue with that longing. What happened if you missed his physical form? What happened if you missed 69 darshan? It doesn't matter at all. Just long. But why did I do that? Why I missed? Just long, long. And that's being with him. That's what he told us. Yeah. How many years ago I told you that? How many?
10 years ago? No, it must have been more than that. Yeah.
When you came first, you know, you wanted to be here. I said, what the heck do you want to
That's
be
right.
here?
That's right. All right, 71, 81, 90,
20 years. 20 years. She doesn't even keep count of time. Hmm. All that we need to have is longing. Yeah. And that generates love. And most important, love. Everything hinges around love. Service is there. Everything is fine. Speaking about him is so good. And all this sort of thing. But it has to be seasoned with love. Then the taste, the aroma comes out. Yeah. And to have that love, you must have longing. And we do have, by His grace, He has blessed us with that. That's the reason why you come. How many trips you have made, you know? How many? Have you kept a count of it? You couldn't. Have
no, it's four.
Huh?
Four.
Four. See? But you want to come, want to be here, want to hear about Him. So these are the symptoms of your ailment, which is known as longing. Yeah.